So good evening, everybody, and Elul is winding its way down. We're already in Slichot. We're in less than a week. Rosh Hashanah, Bo Aleinu Latova. And there's a transition I always find, both before Rosh Hashanah and the Yom Kippur, where I get nervous. I spoke a couple of weeks ago about my own kind of Elul anxiety, even though I try and strengthen myself every year to be confident. There's a moment of anxiety before the High Holy Days, and we're going to look at exactly why tonight. The concept of Yemei Din, the Days of Judgment. What do we mean by Days of Judgment? Who is being judged? Why are we being judged? Over what are we being judged? And what is the consequences of this judgment that is happening to us? So these are anxious days, days of awe, days of nervousness. I spoke before between Mincha Ma'ariv this evening, just very briefly in Shul, about an inbuilt tension into Rosh Hashanah that reflects both a kind of a confidence that we're going into Rosh Hashanah and we're supposed to look nice and eat good food and apple and honey and sweet new year and new clothes and haircuts and manicures, etc. And at the same time, we don't say Hallel because the books of the living and the dead are open before us. These are days of emotions. And the thing about emotions, which is really tonight's class, the thing about emotions is that they are often contradictory. They're almost always contradictory. People feel and relate to different things. On an emotional level, you can absolutely hold two contradictory thoughts or ideas, if not in your head, then in your heart, at the same time. And we're going to see how that really is reflected in the liturgy and in the scholarship around Rosh Hashanah. Where do we know Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment from? Sorry? I want to make tonight more of a kind of a discussion kind of thing, although for the recording, can't have too long a discussion. I may have to edit some of you out. But from where do we know that Rosh Hashanah is indeed a day of judgment? What happened to these sheets? They're red. Okay, so Jeff is saying from the Mishnah. The Mishnah, we have a tradition. So Rosh Hashanah in the Torah is a very opaque festival. It's told Yom HaZikaron, Yom Zikaron Trua. Torah, the tradition that the world is created in Tishrei, the beginning of the year, etc. These are very, very, very tenuous and sometimes really not rooted in text itself. The reason why I wanted to get a machzer was because at the very beginning of Zichronot section of the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, and the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah is one of my favorite prayers. I wouldn't be against a three-day Rosh Hashanah, I have to say. I could say these prayers over and over and over again. But we say on Rosh Hashanah about, we address God, particularly in the Zichronot section, the very middle of the of Musaf. And I'm just trying to find where it is, because this is beautiful Masav, but it's a little bit on just a layout. We talk about the fact that we've got a Baal Musaf here. Mereshit Kazot, oh, here it is. Mereshit Kazot Hodata. From the very beginning, you have told us gods. Umilifnim Ota Gelita. And from the earliest times it has been revealed, Ze Hayom Tchilat Masecha. This is the anniversary of your work of creation. Zikaron Liyom Rishon. It's a memorial for that very first day. Kichok li Yisrael hu, it is a judgment for Israel, or decree for Israel, Mishbat lelokei Yaakov, the day when the God of Jacob judges. So the Machzor itself says, where do we know Rosh Hashanah is from? Hakol Maminim, we all know, everybody knows. Today, everybody knows that this is the day. It's a tradition. It's a tradition handed down Mikedem from the earliest of times. And it is certainly the way that we relate to Rosh Hashanah as a day of judgment. I can't prove from the biblical text, fascinatingly, some people try to, and with some degree of success possibly, I can't prove from the biblical text that inbuilt into the Torah text itself is an indication that Rosh Hashanah is both the anniversary of the universe's creation and the day of judgment. But we live and breathe through Jewish tradition. And that's how we relate to Rosh Hashanah, without question. And in fact, the first Mishnah, or the first source on our sheets on page 1, tells us Ba'arba parakim ha'olam nidon. The very top of page one. Under this picture, by the way, we'll look at this, or I just want to draw your attention to this little picture. What is this a picture of? If you're listening at home or why you Torah, it's justice. What is justice? Justice is blind. Why does justice wear a blindfold? No favorite, because it doesn't make a difference who is being judged. It doesn't make any difference whether or not they are. In fact, even as the Torah tells us, as far as the din, the judicial system, rich or poor, makes no difference. Judge everybody. The Almighty does not judge with a blindfold. The Almighty, and in fact, I came across today, didn't make it onto the sheets, but now, funny enough, has made it into Shir. The Almighty, when He judges us, does not judge us blindfold. He does not say, that person broke Shabbos, that person said Lashon Hara, that person did that terrible Avera. I don't care who they are and what they've done and what their circumstances. Did they break the law? What is the punishment? That is the way that a heavenly, an earthly court, Bet Din and Lahavdil, secular court will judge. The Almighty never judges that way. The Almighty's eyes, Kavah Yochal, are wide open in judgment. So this image of blind justice is not an image that we would ever associate with the Almighty. Ba'arba prakim ha'olam nidon. The world is judged on four occasions. And here in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, the aspect is prosperity. We'll discover. How come there are 4 days of judgment in a year? Ala tavua, bepesach ala tavua. On Pesach, it's decided whether the grain will ripen and be fruitful. Batseret ala peirot, on Shavuot, the fruits, ha'ilan, of the fruit tree. Barash Hashanah, on Rosh Hashanah, first of Tishrei, kol baye ha'olam ovrim lefanav kivnei maron. All baye olam, all creatures of the world pass before Him, by the way, universal, not just Jews, all creatures of the world pass before Him, kivnei maron. And there is a dispute in the Talmud. Kivnei maron can either mean like sheep, or can mean like people passing over, or soldiers, or people passing through a narrow mountain pass. The Almighty judges us, and each one has got those symbolisms. But nonetheless, the Almighty judges us all as individuals, and as a nation, and as humanity. Shneimar, Hayotze Yachad Libam, the one who created together all their hearts, Hamevin El Kol Masehem, and He is the one who understands their deeds. Ubechag Nidon El Amayim, and on Sukkot they're judged about how much water is going to fall. That, by the way, is interesting. And if this was more of a Talmud class, we all had a lucky escape, because this, when I was preparing this class, even as late as this afternoon, this was nearly ended up being a Gemara Shir. Managed to swerve it away from just being a Gemara Shir, though we're going to look at some very important passages in the Talmud tonight. Interestingly enough, what are we judged on Rosh Hashanah? I understand that on Pesach, we are judged, not the grain is judged, whether you are going to be, you're going to end up as a bagel or end up as a pretzel. The grain is not the grain. Humanity is judged for the grain harvest. And on Shavuot, humanity is judged for the fruit. So what is humanity judged for in Rosh Hashanah? So in other words, it's a different kind of judgment. In other words, on Rosh Hashanah, all of humanity is judged about how much grain we're going to have, and on Sukkot, how much water we're going to have. And remember, in the winter, in Israel, when the life and death depends on a healthy rainfall, that is a frantic judgment of Sukkot. That's where Hoshana Rabbah, indeed all of the Hoshanas and Geshem comes from, frantic life and death. On Rosh Hashanah, people are not so much being judged. Well, is the implication that people are being judged for everything else they're being given? Once you take away wheat, fruit, and water, the rest of what I get is going to be judged in Rosh Hashanah? Or is it an entirely different kind of judgment? I'm pointing out a kind of a lack of symmetry in the Mishnah. Clearly, the way that humanity is judged is being judged for something else than water and wheat. And what exactly is the content and the subject of a judgment? We'll come back to that. the Talmud points out, the Gemara points out, and there are many, and we'll see this comes to full fruition in the Unetane Tokef prayer, but no explanation necessary. This is given full expression in the Unetane Tokef prayer, but what exactly are we judged for in Rosh Hashanah? Is it merely who will live and who will die? I mean, that's fairly, imagine, central to anybody's list of, for the coming year. What are we judged for in Rosh Hashanah? So the Talmud, the Gemara, already contains within it a number of traditions. So for example, we find, we'll just go through this, it's just by word of introduction. But Rosh Hashanah, Nifkada, Sarah, Rachel, I left off Hannah from the Hebrew. On Rosh Hashanah, Sarah, Rachel, and Hannah were visited by God and conceived children. We just took delivery today. There's an organization based out of Los Angeles actually called Tikva that helps create space in the Jewish community, helps support couples or individuals struggling with infertility. It is a growing concern. I mean, I can only say that, they deliver every year before Rosh Hashanah for the last 2 or 3 years, a tefillah to be recited for those people davening desperately for children. And Rosh Hashanah, by tradition, is a time when these midrashs were answered. We also find in the Gemara, Rosh Hashanah Yotze Yosef Mibet Hasurin. Yosef's wasn't given a sentence. He wasn't given a fixed number of years. Yosef was languishing in prison. And in Rosh Hashanah, Yosef was freed. And there's a proof text, which we won't get into now. And similarly, it says, Rosh Hashanah Batla Avodah Me'avotenu B'Mitzrayim. Even though the Jewish people came out of Egypt in what time of year? Presumably Pesach. Their avodah, their slavery, ceased on Rosh Hashanah, and that's alluded to in the Tehillim, Perek of Tehillim that I alluded to before, Psalm 81, that talks about Kichok li Yisrael, Mishpat l'Elokei Yaakov. It's a psalm for Thursday, help me out, somebody. Tiku b'chodesh over b'kesel yom chagenu, blow the shofar at the new month, b'kesel yom chagenu, on the one festival of the Jewish year, which is kese, in other words, where the moon is hidden, it's not a full moon, instead the moon is a bare sliver, and that's when we blow shofar. This is a chapter of Tehillim, and it also has allusions to removing the burden, Joseph was freed, etc. So there are a number of allusions, as sages find even in scripture, to the idea that significant things are decided on Rosh Hashanah. And just to turn over to page 2, if you don't mind, and just to tie this to the very beginning of creation, because it's a strong tradition that this day of Rosh Hashanah is not an arbitrary day of judgment. God picked the first day of Tishrei because, sometimes it's around Labor Day, for a different reason. There's a strong tradition, or a rabbinic tradition, that Tishrei is the day, or the first of Tishrei is the anniversary of the creation of the universe of humanity. Where do we get a day of judgment from in the creation story? I actually mentioned this at the class yesterday morning, the Tuesday morning class. Professor Jonathan Grossman, who has spoken here a number of times, brilliant, brilliant Bible scholar, wants to show from a very close reading of Bereshit that the very concept of God both creating, giving birth as well, creating something, and then regarding it as outside. The very fact that you create something and then address it as a separate entity, giving mankind mitzvot, is to a certain extent an act of judgment, because you assess, you identify that birthing is when the child inside you becomes something separate from you. And that's kind of a moment of judgment, because you assess its potential and you instruct and begin guiding accordingly. So there's an element by which inbuilt into the very idea of creation is judgment, in the sense of assessing and commanding and charging and putting on to a particular track. The Midrash says that Adam Arishon, on the day he was created, was extremely busy, was not only created, but sinned by eating the fruit of the tree, and was condemned by God. What did the Almighty tell Adam would happen if they ate of the Eitz Hadas, the tree of the garden? B'yom tocha, no, that was afterwards. B'yom tocha mimenu, And the day you will eat of it, mod yumat, you will die. What happened to Adam? Didn't die, he's sent into exile. So one interpretation has it, no, mod yumat means you become mortal. You were supposed to be immortal, and you become mortal. The other interpretation is that Adam appealed. There was clemency. And that happened on Rosh Hashanah. This is kind of pre-chronological time. So in the first moment of Adam's consciousness, there is both sin, judgment, repentance, and forgiveness, and kapara, and punishment. And that is all part of these very early experiences of humanity. And therefore, God, according to the Midrash in Vayikra, said, "The Holy One, blessed be He, to Adam, this will be model for your descendants. Just as you stood before me in judgment on this day and left with clemency," the Midrash uses the word dimus, "so the future generations of your descendants will stand before me in judgment on this day and will leave with clemency." Which day is that? The first day of the seventh month, Rosh Hashanah. So the rabbis insist that these themes of judgment, of zikaron, of memory, go all the way back, midifnim kezot hodata, as the Machzor says. All of this, by tradition, goes back to the very, very, very beginning. On Rosh Hashanah, there's something very elemental. Returning to rethink again about creation. And by the way, believe me, the last thing I'm about to do is spoil a beautiful evening and start talking about politics. I could say, well, that shouldn't be politics. It's not, but I'm just arguing with myself. But environmentalism, to the extent that, you know, the idea that all human beings, and Jews in particular, should care greatly and deeply about the fate of the planet is something extremely important in Torah. And when we regard ourselves, again, I'm not saying I'm making any partisan political points, whatever, zero emissions, or this emissions, or that emissions, whatever, I'm just pointing out that having a day where we remember that this world is a created world, was created in a state of pristine beauty, as was humanity created in a state of pristine beauty, is a day of, as well as, you know, as well as the nerves that come from judgment, is a day of searing beauty. It's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful idea that remember that this world, when I remember back in the day, when I used to live in London, and I used to walk on the second day of Rosh Hashanah to the overflow service, the other service, and it was a little bit further of a walk, and it was through some relatively quiet streets, whatever. I used to, then a little bit of greenery through a park. I used to think about, wow, look at this. This is what the world was like, and the day it was created. It was just so fresh and clean and new. I walk down Broadway on Shul and Rosh Hashanah morning. Don't necessarily get that same kind of pristine vibe, whatever. But we should. Rosh Hashanah is a great day for checking in with the fact that the world was created beautiful. I was created beautiful. And Rosh Hashanah is a time to kind of remember that. Let's turn our attention. First of all, we'll look at the prayer. And then we'll look at the sources for the prayer. But without question, the prayer that seems to most typify, characterize people's experience of the High Holy Days is a Netanya Tokef. When Netanya Tokef, we'll look a moment about the authorship. The authorship is not really our business tonight, but since it's impossible to discuss it without learning the prayer, without reading its incredible origin story or stories, and we'll talk about that as well. Netanya Tokef is a prayer that we recite at Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, in the reader's repetition of Musaf of Rosh Hashanah and of Yom Kippur. It has a particular place in the Machzor. It is recited right before Kedusha. In fact, it's an introduction to Kedusha. Now, sometimes Kedusha is a long way away. Normally, in a regular weekday or Shabbos, you start the reader's repetition, you're up to Kedusha before you know it. And Yom Kippur, and certainly the first day of Rosh Hashanah, certainly Yom Kippur, that is far from the case. But nonetheless, once all of the other poems and piyutim are done, and they all have their role as well, right before Kedusha, where we proclaim that our mission is, like the angels, to declare God's existence and holiness in the universe. In mere fact, Kadosh, 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 God exists and is holy and is imminent everywhere, we recite this in the Netanya Tokef prayer. Now, we think Unatana Tokef is a bit what we all say on Rosh Hashanah, it's written, and Yom Kippur will die. I remember once I was in a full of little anecdotes tonight. But I was in, when I once davened in yeshiva in London on Rosh Hashanah, and I was sitting at a table with, it was really a yeshiva for kind of balabat. It was a base medrash in Golders Green in London. And I was sitting, I wanted to dive in there the year that, the first year before I had any rabbinic duties. And remember, I was sitting at a short, small table with a man, like a kind of a, you know, Orthodox individual, who were two or three small children with them. And they were bored out of their minds. This was a yeshivish davening. It was going on for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Anyway, got to Natan Tokef, and these kids, by now, they'd been in the shul for about 8 hours, and they're like, going to the minds of boredom. But came to the bit where you're all supposed to shout out, Utshuva, Utfila, and stuff. This man was unsatisfied with the fervor that his young 3 and 4 year old children were able to muster. So he started like smacking them on the back of the head. Like, no! I'll never forget. The following day, I went to Neri, so I went to Rabbi Kimchi's shul the next day for Musa. But I'll never, kind of never forget. I'm pretty sure those kids will never, I doubt they're religious to this anymore, but I'm sure they'll never forget Unatana Tokef. So whether or not your memory of being whacked over the head by parents in Unatana Tokef is that your memory or not, nonetheless, it is a very, very powerful prayer. It contains within it many more themes than that peak point. In fact, Unatana Tokef is a longer prayer than you realize. It begins, or it finishes later than you might think. And we're going to study the lines of Unatana Tokef, because it contains within it more than just a statement. This is a day we're being judged. This is real, and it's happening now. And what's the phrase? And you're totally unprepared. And you have to fix this all before Yom Kippur, otherwise you're going to be in real trouble. There's more to Unatana Tokef than that. And in fact, let's just look through the words of the prayer. Reuven is here. I'm tempted to ask him to sing it. Maybe he can hum along as I read it. Page 2. Unetane tokev kedushat hayom. Let us give tokev, power. Let us ascribe greatness, lend power. Let us say over the holiness of the day. Remember, this is an introduction to Kedusha. Kihu nora va'ayom. It is awesome va'ayom and terrifying, awe-filled. Uvoti nasei malchutecha. On this day, God, your kingship is lifted up. God is manifest on Rosh Hashanah through the power of his justice, his judgment. Only he gets to judge humanity, because only he can judge humanity. He is the only one. And actually, we all have to remember Rosh Hashanah, whatever else we take away from this class tonight, and don't take away. All of the things that we are most hopeful for in our life, we'll work hard and we'll try best, and we'll look after our health, but we know all of the things that we really, truly want and desire are really up to Hashem. There are people who look after themselves with excellent health and painstaking care, and lo aleinu die young. And there are people who work their fingers to the bone, and the smartest people, and they've been to the best schools, and they struggle to make a parnasa. And should I turn the tape off for this? And at the time, there are people who are as lazy as anything, and as in England we would say, as thick as two short planks, and are absolutely loaded. So we have no idea why. We have no idea why. It's a gift from Hashem. Almost everything that we really, really want, and we're investing and thinking we're doing, ultimately comes from Hashem. And God's kingship is lifted up on Rosh Hashanah. Uvo tinaseh malchutecha. Your kingship is lifted up because we recognize, at least on Rosh Hashanah, that this is God. V'chon b'chesed kisecha. Your throne stands, is established, is firm on kindness. V'teishav alav be'emet. And you, God, will sit on it in truth. Emet, ki ata hu dayan, you are the judge. Umochiach, and you rebuke. V'yodea, and you know. V'aid, and you testify. V'chotev, v'chotem, v'sofer, and you write, and you seal, and you count, and you reckon and enumerate. V'tizkor kol hanishkachot. You remember everything which is forgotten. V'tiftach et sefer hazikaranot. This image of a book. Now, the book here is an allusion, as we'll see, to a this prayer is based on a very central and important Talmudic passage, which we'll look at soon. But the book is open. Many commentators, by the way, we have a member of the shul, Eitan Kimmelman, one of the young families in our shul. His father, Professor Reuven Kimmelman, is a professor of Jewish studies, I think, at Brandeis, wrote a wonderful scholarly commentary on Unetane Tokef, and traces many of the biblical allusions. The idea of a book is opened, brought before God, like the king, Achashverosh, the night when Mordechai's goodness is affected, the fate of the Jewish people is about to be lost forever, and yet somehow or other that book is opened before the king, v'tivtach et zichronot, and God remembers that which has been forgotten. U'me'elav yikare. And it reads it, either it means, and you God, u'me'elav yikare, it is read, from it you read, he reads, or u'me'elav yikare, somehow or other this book reads itself. V'chotam yad kol adam bo, everybody's signature in the book. It is not so much, and this is not a far-fetched or stretched interpretation or insight, it is not so much that God writes us in the book on Rosh Hashanah. We write ourselves in that book all year long. V'chotem yad kol, your signature, you've already signed on it. Your v'chotem yad kol adam bo, your signature is already in the book. And therefore there is this, and we'll see the significance of this idea. But this very kind of gentle, rhythmic, no matter how, which tune it's sung to, this very rhythmic kind of poem describes the idea that this is a day of judgment, God's kingship is established, and God is not passive in judgment. He is the sole judge. There are no other witnesses, there are not even any other court officials. He, God, is intimately involved in every single process of the judgment because he alone has this insight into what we have all done and what we've all been and who we are. And while God, if you like, is quietly mulling over, this is drama, while God is sort of quietly mulling over creation and reading up what we've been up to, he's like scrolling through your Facebook account, if you like, and he's seeing what are you proud of this year? Ubeshofar gadol yitaka. There's also a reaction. The great shofar is sounded. V'kol damama daka yishama. And the still small voice sounds. And this contrast between these two ideas. The great shofar, the shofar of judgment. Who sounds the shofar? The angels, perhaps, or humanity, or the universe resonates with this great shofar. And at the same time, kol damama daka. Where does the kol damama daka come from? Eliyahu, Elijah, when he goes back to Mount Sinai, and God is not in the wind, and he's not in the tempest, and he's not in the fire, and the thunder, and the storm. And then, kol damadaka, the still small voice. And it's actually interesting. I want to say it's an allusion. I may mention this at some point over Rosh Hashanah, but this, just actually last night, this idea occurred to me. You know, we live in a world where all we hear is the shofar gadol, the great cacophonous sound. They're always, not just because in New York, there's always horns and beep, beep, beeps, etc. But actually, when I go to Israel and Alan Shfut and I'm in yeshiva, the first two nights I cannot sleep. It's so quiet. I want to play a soundtrack of sirens on Western Avenue to lull me gently to sleep. But it's not just the noise of our environment. Everybody's always telling us what's urgent for now. What you need to care about this now. You need to lean in. This is the story of the day, the hour, the moment. The shofar gadol sounds, but what's really important is the kol damadaka, the still small voice that really claims our attention. Yishama u'melachim yechavezun. Angels tremble. V'chil u'rada yochezun. They are possessed by a sense of trembling. At a Levaya the other day, Rabbi Kelemer Shlita from West Hempstead interpreted Eshet Chayil in the light of this word, v'chil, to tremble. Eshet Chayil, a woman who trembles, who is anxious to make sure that everything is done properly in the orbits of her influence. Ra'adaya chazedun v'omru hine yom hadin. So there's this contrast between this kind of meditative, almost automatic, natural process. Hey, it's Rosh Hashanah. It's the anniversary of creation. God's kingship is renewed on this day. The books are opened, read quietly before God. And then there's this cacophonous, the angels are trembling. Hine yom adin. I'm not so big an expert in angels, but one could ask the question, angels can't do anything wrong. Like, what are they so scared of? Believe me, I'm no angel. I'm plenty worried about Rosh Hashanah, but what are the angels so worried about? Hine yom hadin, lifkod al tzava marom badin. You, God, have come to visit on all of the hosts on high in judgment. Ki lo yisku be'enecha badin. Nobody can really be innocent, entirely blameless. In din, v'chol baye olam yavru lefanecha kibnei menaron. Now we see this direct allusion to the Mishnah, and all creatures pass before you like sheep. And then this is not so well broken up. Obviously, there's musical shifts at these kind of points. Kivakarat roe edro mavir tzono tachat shifto. And now it shifts from God as the king on judgment, or the judge. Now God is a shepherd. And while the angel, and look at the contrast in this prayer, while the angels, what are they so worried about? What are they so, they're trembling at this kind of, it sounds like God is angry. Nobody can possibly be acquitted. Because nobody can say they did their best. Nobody can say I'm truly innocent. And then we're told that God passes over us like a shepherd. Now, if the idea is, as the Mishnah implies, that we're judged one by one, there are other ways, as the Talmud suggests, of understanding that phrase, kibnei maron. If the idea is we're judged one by one, it could say we're judged the way a master assesses his workers, or the way that a general assesses his troops. A shepherd tending to the flock has an aspect of compassion to it. Even though there's a decision that's being made about which sheep are literally about to become chops. He passes the flock one by one underneath his staff. Ken tavir v'tispor v'timne v'tivkod nefesh kochai. Like a shepherd, so to you, God, do you count and do you assess and do you judge the souls of every living being. V'tachtoch kitzva l'kol b'riya v'tichta v'gezar dinam. You give an allotment of life to every creature and you write down what their fate is going to be. Let me ask you a question. When these words are said in shul, what's your feeling? When we have the image of the shepherd, how does that make you feel? Is it scary because now is the moment when I'm being counted under the staff? Or is it, I feel safe because the shepherd is always regarded as a compassionate, caring, kind of heroic figure, really, really involved with the welfare of his flock? How do you feel when we invoke at this point in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur the shepherd motif? What's that? Bina? It's what? You feel insignificant. Okay.
I'm the major hero.
Yeah, so the shepherd is an idea of biblical, the good guy. King David, Moshe Rabbeinu were shepherds. It's a sign of, righteousness. It's a sign of, you're kind of safe with the shepherd. Reuven?
Actually, I feel both cared for as well as vulnerable.
Interesting. Reuven says he feels cared for and vulnerable. I'm going to change my answer to what he said. Because... there's an element of both, because you are being counted, but on the other hand, it is a caring idea. Abe, last contribution?
Psalm 23, the Lord is my
shepherd. Right, Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, right? So it's Hashem Roeh.
I prefer the image that a police officer gets.
Right, that would be a little more scary. So, and then we're told, the very bottom of page 2, but Rosh Hashanah yikatevun, on Rosh Hashanah it is written, ubiyom som kippur yichatemun, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed. Kama Yavne. Now remember, we'll see the Talmudic passage in a second, but we already saw some Agadata from the Talmud that talked about Rachel and Sarah being visited with children and Joseph being freed. On Rosh Hashanah it is written, Yom Kippur it is sealed. Kama Yavrun v'kama Yeberun. Who will pass away and who will be born? Mi Yichye u'mi Yamut. Who will live, who will have life, and who will die? Mi Bekitso, mi Lo Bekitso. Who in the proper time, who not in the proper time? Mi v'mayim u'mi ba'esh. Who by water, who by fire? And I just want to say, by the way, first of all, in our shul, unfortunately, and even since last week's year, I know of at least four cases of our in this past year since last Rosh Hashanah, of personally been to four, or when I was in Israel, four occasions of young people associated with our shul, in other words, close relatives or members of our shul, or members of our shul passed away, leaving young children to say Kaddish for them. Do not remember a year contains so many untimely deaths. This year, this past summer, there were a number of tragic drownings in the Jewish community as well. Mi b'mayim u'mi b'esh, mi b'cherev u'mi b'chaya, who by swords and who by wild animal, mi b'rav u'mi b'tzama, who will starve and who will thirst to death, mi b'rash u'mi b'mageifa, who by, I think, earthquake and who by plague, mi v'chanicho, mi b'skila, who will be strangled and who will be stoned, mi yanuach u'mi yanua, who will be at peace and who will be harried to the grave, mi shaket u'mi yitaraf, who will be, same idea, who will be at peace, who will have tranquility and who will not, mi yishalev u'mi yasar, mi ani u'mi yasher, who will be rich and who will be poor, mi yushupal u'mi yarum, who will be brought low and who will be raised high. And then, again, this is not broken up in the right way, and then we all call out, utshuva, utfila, utstaka, mavirin et ro hagazera. So there is this very stark laying out that it's all happening now, that Rosh Hashanah suddenly becomes imminent, intimate and imminent. And it's more than just who will live and who will die. The manner of death, the time of death, and the other circumstances of one's life are suddenly spelled out in the starkest way. And then again, to that, there is a response. Even though in Rosh Hashanah it's written, and it's sealed in Yom Kippur, tshuva utfila utstaka mavirin et ro hagezeira. These words, by the way, are some of the most hotly debated words in Jewish philosophy. Because does it mean that on Rosh Hashanah it's written, and if I'm able to fit in some tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah between now and Yom Kippur, I might get myself out of the wrong book and into the right book? Or is it that even though it is written on Rosh Hashanah, and despite the fact that it is sealed in Yom Kippur, tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, mavir, nevorah, gezerah, always? Actually, we don't know. I mean, none of us know, because this is God's judgment and it's inscrutable to us. But the mere understanding of actually, after Yom Kippur, can you still change your fate, is hotly debated. And I want to point out, and we're going to see in a moment, our ability to wrap our heads around this very quickly runs out of steam. Because suddenly, I will leave the questions. The question is on the sheet, and I have some excerpts from people who had tragically difficult circumstances and wrote beautifully and poignantly how much they struggled with the prayer of Netanya Tokef. And we'll give full honor to those emotions. On a cognitive level, there are all sorts of reasons why this doesn't seem to fully make sense, because once you start thinking about God's process of judgment and, well, why was this person written for life and this person, you know, it something doesn't quite compute, and we'll try and show what it is and why it is and how we try and understand the story. But at the end of the day, we have to take this prayer as an emotional experience rather than a shiur, a lesson in God's judgment. As I mentioned, however, the prayer is not done yet. Many people think that's the end of Netanya Tokef, and then you go into the next kind of bit. And the Chazan might sing Ein Kitzva in a moment, or he might not. This is actually still part of Netanya Tokef. Ki kishimcha ken tilatecha. Like your name is your praise. Your name is like your praise. Kasha likos v'noach lirtzot. You, God, are very hard to make angry and very easy to appease. Ki lo tachbot b'mot hamet. You do not want the death of the person who's due to die. Ki b'shuvu midarcho v'chaya. Instead, we say this verse in Nila as well. We want him to do tshuva, to change his ways and live. V'ad yom moto techake lo. And you will await him to his day of death. Now, what does that mean? If I was sealed on Rosh Hashanah, that I was going, on Yom Kippur, that I was going to die, what does that mean? God is waiting for me to the day of my death. Something's not quite right. V'yad yom oto, but never mind, we're going to look at this in an emotional level. V'yad yom oto techake lo. You got to wait every human being until the last day. Im yashuv miyad tekablo. If he does tshuva, you receive him immediately. Emet ki atahu yotzram v'yada yotzram. It's true, you are the creator, and you know their nature. God's the very fact that God is the King and the Creator and the only one who knows the count itself becomes the source of His mercy. Because at the end of the day, God, even though nobody can be fully innocent before you in judgment, nonetheless, every human being has a right to expect your mercy. Because you know us all. You know us all intimate. You know us better than we know ourselves. Ki atahu yotzram v'yodeh yotzram. You are a creature and you know our nature. Ki hem basar v'dam. We are ultimately frail. We're human beings. And we do our best. And very often we don't do even nearly our best. But nonetheless, we are frail and we recognize that. Adam yesodo mi'afar v'sofa le'afar. A person comes, and this is all part of Matan Tokef. A person comes from dust and returns to dust. Benavsho yavi lachmo. When I'm having a really difficult day, I say this stitch to myself. Benavsho yavi lachmo. Human beings bring their bread, they earn their living, almost it takes everything just to put bread on the table. Mashul kecheres hanishbar. What is a human being? We're appealing to God's man. We're telling God how broken we are. We are compared ultimately to a broken shard. Kechatsir yavesh, like withered grass. Ukitsitz novel, like like dry grass, like a withered flower. Ketzel over, like a passing shadow. Chanan kala, like an evaporating cloud. Karuach noshevet. A breeze that passes, ka'afak porach v'kalom ya'uf, like dust in the wind, like a dream. And that's the span of a human being's life. We're all here for the shortest time. You look back, and you think to yourself, what happened? What happened? Where did the years go? What just happened? Ka'chalom ya'uf. Person's life is just like a dream, like it's just so ephemeral. V'ata hu melech kel chai v'kayam. And you, God, are the King who endures and lives forever. And our strength and our appeal is just to be part of that, to be part of something bigger, to know that we're creatures of God, not to forget, not to think that we temporary, fragile, lowly, flawed human beings are the pinnacle of everything, that we are our own masters and in charge of our destiny and get to do whatever we choose just because we want to. Our only justification for din is the fact that we hold on, we embrace, we reach up and we say, we're part of your plan. We're part of your plan, God. So very quickly, let me just point out by the Natana Tokef itself. Who wrote the Natana Tokef? So it used to be thought, because the article of Machzor says it, that it was written by a gentleman called Rav Amnon Mentz. Amnon Mentz was a scholar in the time of the First Crusades, a rabbi, who, and at the time, the Jewish people were facing terrible, terrible persecution. So Rhineland Jewish communities were wiped out and had successive massacres in the worst possible time. They live in the 12th century. And there's an old, old tradition that was apparently printed in 13th century Machzors, like early, early, early Machzors, that Unetane Tokev was written by this great sage upon being martyred. And what happened famously was that the bishop told him that I'll spare your life and I'll reward you if you convert to Christianity. And the rabbi said, I want to think. He had no intention of doing it, but he played for time by saying, give me a day or two to think it over. God forbids. Jew can't even ever imply that it's even an option. So, of course, he came back to the bishop and he said, no way. And in punishment, rather than killing him swiftly, he started cutting off his limbs. And as he lay dying, he asked to be brought to shul at Rosh Hashanah. And before Kedusha was recited at that point in the service, he said, he taught the community the Natan Tokef prayer. And that was something. And now that tradition, this is not invented by Art Scroll. This is a tradition that is many, many, many centuries old. It goes way back to, as I said before, 13th century texts describe the authorship of this prayer. When the Geniza, the Cambridge Geniza, was discovered, so it was discovered that, in fact, the Natan Tokef is considerably older. It's an older prayer than that. And which itself is, itself is kind of astonishing because the idea that that the authorship of such a venerable prayer would be kind of mixed up. So this is actually, and we're just going to look at page 4 very quickly. I just want to draw your attention to it because it's actually important. So Unatana Tokev was apparently written in Babel or maybe in Eretz Yisrael centuries and centuries and centuries before Rabbi Amnon of Mentz. So this is actually, Rabbi Kenny Brander wrote an extremely well-researched, actually very moving article about the authorship of Unatana Tokev. And it's worthwhile just spending a moment on this. A manuscript is found in the Cairo Geniza that raises questions about the entire historical premise of Natan Tokef. This manuscript is a text of Natan Tokef and was clearly written before the 11th century CE. Rav Amnon of Mentz could not have written Natan Tokef. This problem was publicized by many, including Professor Daniel Goldschmidt. Since the publication of Professor Goldschmidt's Machzor, new manuscripts were discovered. It appears that Natan Tokef was written by a composer by the name of Yanai, who, according to some, was the teacher of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir and lived in Israel sometime between the 4th and 7th century. And if you read or reread, as I recently did, the book Sacred Trash, which is a great history of the Cairo Geniza, those figures of HaKalir and Yanai are extremely important figures in liturgy. So Rabbi Brander writes, one critical question remains. If Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn was an expert in the liturgy of Yanai, why would he attribute Yanai's Natan Tokef to Rav Amnon? In other words, the person who attributed it first, the tradition this was written of Amnon, was quite an act, knew the real author. Natan Tokef was placed in our Rosh Hashanah prayers as part of the introduction to Kedusha. The period prayer that introduces Kedusha contained 4 sections. Prior to the First Crusade, a period of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir was recited. The last section of the introduction, known as the Siluk, narrates a conversation between the angels and God. The angels approach God and ask, why do the Jewish people continue to be in your good grace? They don't treat you properly, listen to your words. You should not forgive them. Hashem defends us, and the angels continue, why do you defend the Jewish people? They don't listen to you, and you're sinners. Once again, Hashem responds and settles the question. The angels then praise Hashem with Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. In other words, the original Machzor, if you can say such a thing, from the time of the 4th, 5th, 6th century, contained within it words of real rebuke to the community. You're only here because of divine justice. Really, you deserve to be destroyed. You should really say Kedusha to God with gratitude because you really should all have been wiped out long ago. And during the time of the First Crusades, time of unbearable persecution for the Jewish people, unbearable persecution, they switched that prayer out and they inserted in Natan Tokef. And doubtless, Rav Amnon of Mentz, his martyrdom, it's not that, as maybe some people thought, assumed, that he wrote that prayer, he came to shul as dying invalid, and he said, no, we're not going to say this prayer, we're going to say the other one. We're going to say Natan Tokef now at this point of Kedusha. And we'll see why in a second. Sometime after the First Crusade, the Siluk was removed and replaced with Yanai's Natan Tokef. For how could the Rhineland communities tolerate such an introduction to Kedusha? They witnessed unprecedented acts of martyrdom within the Jewish community, acts of resistance against forced baptism by the Catholic Church, which included the taking of their own lives and the lives of their family. It did not seem appropriate to introduce Kedusha with the critique of the Jewish people by the angels when Jews were sacrificing their lives and the lives of their families in order to observe the Torah. When Natan Tokef still has the theme that God is the judge, and the Jews of Rhineland could no more explain what was happening to them then we can explain the Holocaust or other or tragedies that happen in our own lives. We can't. But they said we can't simply relate to this as punishment. Unatana Tokef is about God's judgment and the implication of punishment. And some people are going to die, and some people are going to be sick, and some people are going to become poor, and some people are going to suffer, and others won't. But it's also a prayer that does not in any way seek to be privileged to the why. Who knows? In Unatana Tokef, who knows why God judges the way he does? Who knows? Atahu Dayan, you are the judge, and you are the witness, and you are the mochiach, and you're the only one who can rebuke, and you're the only one who can write down. It's a prayer about the complexities, the contradictions of good people suffering, and nobody knowing why. And of course, as Jews, we say, as we always do, you God are the Dayan Emet. I'm not going to tell you you're wrong. I'm not going to tell you how to run the universe, because you created and I didn't. And I live with this awareness and this vulnerability and this terror that things may be awfully difficult. And I also live, which Ruben said before, with this astonishing vulnerability and this astonishing comfort that it's you, God, the one who knows us and the one who will never tire of appealing and hoping for your mercy. And that was the great switch that happened in the result of this, of the Holocaust of its day, which was the Crusades, that the community switched out, and no doubt by something to do with the personal insistance of this tzaddik Rav Amnon of Mentz. It did not seem appropriate to introduce a condition with the creed of the Jewish people by the angels when Jews were sacrificing their lives and the lives of their families in order to observe the Torah. The ideals found in Yannai's and Natana Kosev seem much more apropos to the circumstances of the Rhineland community, and this is why it replaced the original Siluk. And I agree with that, endorse that idea, Rabbi Brander's theory, 100%. Very quickly, and it's probably good that we didn't leave too much time for a tremendous amount of theology, turn over to page 5. I'll do that thing where I'll summarize some of the most complicated ideas in Judaism in about 2 minutes. So look at this text here. Rosh Hashanah, Masechet, Talmud Bavli, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, page 16b, is without question, Tetzayin Amud Bet, the source, and following paragraphs in the Gemara as well, the source for the imagery and the idea and the theology of Natana Tokef. Amar Rav Kruspad, at the top of page 5. Amar Rav Kruspadai, Amar Rav Yochanan, Shlosh Sfarim Niftachin B'Rosh Hashanah. Three books are opened on Rosh Hashanah. Echad Shel Rishayim Gemurim, one for very bad people. Echad Shel Tzadikim Gemurim, one for very righteous people. The Echad Shel Beinonim, and one for middling people. Tzadikim Gemurim Nichtavim V'Nechtanim La'Altar. The very righteous are written and sealed immediately, l'chaim, for life. Rishayim gemurim nichtavim v'nichtamim la'altar. The very wicked are written for death immediately. Beinonim taluim v'omdim. The middle kind are kept suspended and standing. Mirosh Hashanah v'ad Yom Kippurim. In the days of Rosh Hashanah and Kippurim, zaku nichtavim l'chaim. If they merit, they get into the book of life. Lo zaku nichtavim l'mita. If they don't, they get into the book of death. Now, that is a very stark image, and ultimately what we think about when we talk about Unatana Tokef, we think about when we think about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the 10 days of penitence, the scales of judgment. It's written on Rosh Hashanah, sealed in Yom Kippur. And by the way, that's reflected, of course, in the liturgy. We're going to start saying on Sunday night, B'Seif Rechaim, Brach V'Shalom, what are we going to say? Then, et cetera, write as in the book. And then in the Ilah, everything is going to say, Ubesefer Chaim, V'techatem. The language changes from writing to sealing. So we have this strong visceral reaction. Commentators ask, we'll read one line of the Rambam, Maimonides. Takes his Gemara extremely seriously, very literally. And in Hilchot Tshuva, in the laws of repentance, he writes, and this is the next paragraph, this is just to sort of show you right on the nose how difficult the real question is when you begin to think about it, and as which I'm sure you've done many times. Adam shavanotav merubim al zuchuyotav. If a person's sins are more than their merits, Miyad hu met berasho. He will die immediately. Shneimar rav avonach. As it says, the Pasuk of Yirmiyahu, because of your many sins, I have afflicted you. V'chen medina shavonoteh merubim miyad hu ovedet. If you have a country who's got more sins than merits, it will immediately be destroyed. Shneimar zakat Sodom v'Amora. After all, God destroyed Sodom and Amora. V'chen kol olam kula, the whole world, if it had more sins than merits, the world would immediately be destroyed. And that's why Rambam goes on to say, therefore we should always see ourselves as a world equally balanced, and every mitzvah counts, never pass up an opportunity to do something. Who knows, you might be the one that gets to save the world. The very literal, almost naively literal reading of this Talmudic passage raises an obvious question. Jeff, what is the obvious question? I should never say what's the obvious question. Well, so, you know, the Rambam seems to say, even without, he goes on to talk about how this fits, and we're judged on Rosh Hashanah as well. So even though the Rambam talks about this happens kind of an instant basis, it leads to the impression that wicked people die and living people are good. Which is actually the opposite, because if you go to a funeral, you're always told about how good the person was, and everybody else says about when they're alive, everybody says about how bad they are. It seems to be the opposite. But not to be, to leave aside an ill-placed moment of facetiousness, this is an extreme problem, because the Rambam seems to imply that death happens because of wickedness, and death is the inevitable and instant or near to instant response to wickedness. That if you are a bad person, you will die. And of course, we know, and all the commentators ask, that wickedness stalks the world, and there are wicked people and generations and Nazis and all sorts of terrible people out there. And how could the Rambam possibly say that wicked people die immediately if they ever get to the point where they've done more harm than good in their lives, more sins than good things? The Rambam takes this idea very literally, that death is a consequence, is almost an inevitable and swift consequence for sin. But when you think about it, doesn't even begin to make sense. And how, by the way, does the Talmud and Rabbi Kruspa and the Rambam, it actually slightly differs from Unatana Tokef. Even though Unatana Tokef reflects this theology, at the end of the day, our life and death is a result of God's judgment on us. And the judgment is clearly going to be correlated to our deeds. So at the end of the day, it does seem to imply that life is a reward for being good, and therefore death is a reward as a punishment for being bad. And that clearly is extremely troubling idea. And it's not me, we modern sensitive people, we don't ever want to be told that there's anything ever wrong with it. No, this is something which is really problematic. Lee.
So, also, the thing about the Tokef and saying, you know, those will die
So we'll see that idea in one. Well, that line about me so who in the proper time or not. So correct. So I want to, Reuven.
The only other thought that I would add is that perhaps this isn't talking about the perfect people and the evil people. That this is basically saying your perception that there's perfect people and evil people are wrong. Everyone is bent on it. Every nation is bent on it.
And the Nazis who stalked the world for 12 terrible years. You could be, you're right, and it's a theory that could be.
It's more problematic, though, to go and say that they lived for years and wreaked terrible destruction.
Yeah. So the question does not get. So let me point out, just whatever. First of all, it's impossible that the Unatana Tokef, although it does say that the way to redeem the decree is through tshuva. Unatana Tokef itself does not imply that a person is that the decision of God whether or not you will live or die in the coming year or be rich or poor is necessarily because you're a bad person or a good person. It doesn't say that. Even though the Gemara says if you're wicked you will die, In fact, the Netanya Tokev does not say that. It doesn't say why God judges us, but it says we are judged, or we reach a moment of fate on Rosh Hashanah. What's going to happen to us is going to be decided in the coming year. And then it goes on to say, but a person can always attempt to mitigate the judgment. Now, I've seen it. We'll see it in a second as well. So people then will then ask the question. I lost a dear, somebody died before their time. Before their time. Is that because he didn't give tzedakah? Isn't that because, all right, so they were written, on, but they didn't do enough tshuva? It doesn't really help the question. Yeah, right, who had no bechir, exactly. So that's the Rambam, and that's a very literal reading of the Gemara. Tosfos asked the question, well, that's actually just see on the sheet. It's a long Tosfos, but it boils down to one line on page 6. Tosfos says, because the Kurahacha Gabi Shai, Mita, Gabi Tzadim Chaim, so I'm reading very fast, page 6, and the first Hebrew line, everything referred to in this passage of Talmud about the books and the writing and the sealing, right, regarding death for the wicked and life for the righteous, Klomer Lechaya Olam Haba. According to the Tosfos, it's not talking about whether you live or die. It's talking, and then there, the problem goes away. It's not talking about whether you're going to actually live or die in the coming year. It's talking about whether or not you're going to go to Olam Haba or not. It also doesn't make sense. Because what does that mean? That if I'm judged on Rosh Hashanah, that I'm going to go to Gehenna if I die, and then I do shoot that, and it's sealed? Tosfos are bothered by what we're bothered by. What I'm really trying to say this very quickly, then we're going to wrap up the class by just pointing out some important passages, is that we have no idea what this means. We really have no idea. But at the same time, we assess this at a level of not just cognitive logic, but of emotion. We do feel, we do understand that Rosh Hashanah is a time of judgment. We get that, we understand that. We feel it viscerally. The Machzor itself says, you know, we everybody sort of gets this. How it works, we really have no idea. Ravid, the great commentator in the Rambam, says what Lee says. Maybe it means that people are born and they're given an allotted lifespan, and then the calculation is, if they're very good, maybe they'll merit more years, and if they're very wicked, maybe they'll merit less years. So if, God forbid, this happened last week and a former member of Rashul passed away suddenly at the age of 41, 42, we have no idea. Maybe that was his allotted span. Maybe he was only allotted less and he was given more. We have no idea. No idea. And just here, now, Harold Kushner, of course, in the book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, famously struggled with the very question. I can't believe in a God who does bad things. I don't want to believe in a God that will strangle and drown and burn and lower and humiliate and impoverish. I don't believe in that God. I only believe in the God that does the good things. And therefore, he creates a theology. It's the record. And since this isn't shul based medrash, it's heresy. It's apikorsis from a traditional Jewish point of view. That God is nice, but kind of somewhat limited. He's a good guy. He's a good God. But he can always help. And therefore, when bad things happen, it's because God was unable to help you. And that's, you know, dualism, like evil, good and evil, are competing forces, and that's not in any way at all the way the Jews, the Hebrew Bible, that God is absolutely the Melech, views it. But that was Harold Kushner's answer to this profound theological question. And I want to just point out, look at this chat, and I mean, we all relate to this in some level. This is written by an individual who lost a dear relative very swiftly, very suddenly, very tragically. And she writes, although the Otana Tokef, at the bottom of page 6, had long made me uneasy with its stark imagery and invocation of a supernatural God I didn't believe in, after my mother died, the prayer took on a very personal meaning. That God had taken my mother's life because she hadn't sufficiently repented, prayed, or performed righteous acts. I couldn't accept that, and I haven't said that prayer since. And then she writes in this lengthy article about how she came to a rabbi who eventually was able to help her accept maybe mavirin et roa gezerah, it's not a punishment, these things happen in life, and if a person is charitable and compassionate, they'll sometimes make peace with what's happened. It's not for me to question anybody's suffering or pain or the way that they process these kind of things. I wanted to bring these sources to show that it's just a failure of imagination not to understand why at least the person sitting next to you in shul, if not you yourself, may have profound difficulties with reciting these words of prayers. About, what year are we in now? Over about 25 years ago, there was a family friend of ours, Danny Fry in Israel, was murdered in a terror attack. And I remember his, you know, the family telling me afterwards that his father, extremely pious individual, just couldn't sit in shul in the Tanya Tokef. Just had to leave. Just the pain was just indescribable. The Gemara relates a question about the very fact. Okay, so God has decided. Then what? There is a live debate. And I pointed out that it's ambiguous. It's left ambiguous in the words of Netanya Tokef itself. Talmud seems to indicate, certainly Rabbi Kruspadai in the Gemara and the Rambam, Maimonides, seem to indicate that a person, by the way, there's no Rav Kook. This class is called Maimonides, there's no Rav Kook. You're entitled to a full refund. Rav Kruspadai, theology talks about the fact that it is written in Rosh Hashanah, it is sealed in Yom Kippur, and that is that. There is a lengthy and ultimately non-concluded, inconclusive debate in the Gemara about whether or not, the Gemara concludes that a tzibur, a community, can always change their fate after Yom Kippur, which is why we would have a fast day, a communal fast day of tragedy, of mourning, of fasting, to try and avert the question. The Gemara actually asks the question, what is the point of praying for people to get better? Wasn't it sealed on Rosh Hashanah, a written Rosh Hashanah, and sealed in Yom Kippur? So what is the point for ever davening for somebody's refuah? It's too late, presumably. So the Gemara kind of understands that that's not the way that we... However, whatever the words in the Tanya Tokef and the Gemara say, we know that life is considerably more challenging. So the Gemara leaves this question really open, unconcluded. Can an individual, with prayer and sincere intent, change their fate? Let me ask you another question. I'm deliberately speeding very forward to the end here because we're going a little bit over time. A person is sealed for life in Yom Kippur. And let's say for some reason or other they happen to know it or intuit it. Maybe they counted out their sins and their veras. They have an app. And they know that they were well within the safe zone. So what does that mean? That I can drive without a seatbelt? That I can, you know, eat romaine lettuce during a E. coli outbreak. How reckless can you be? If you're sealed for life, is that carte blanche? So the Gemara says, why not? I'm sealed for life. So the Gemara says that there are three things that reawaken a din against a person. Shalosh davari maskir navonotav shel adam. Basically, it is possible to reawaken, to have your file opened up again. It's a Gemara on the bottom of page 7 in Rosh Hashanah. And one of them is if you stand by a wall that is about to fall. The laws of physics indicate that this wall is about to fall down. If you're righteous, are you able to stand next to that wall? And no, in other words, in an earthquake, so the Gemara says, no, clearly the life world is much more complicated than that. There are dangerous things and dangerous situations and dangerous places. And therefore, the conclusion of the Gemara, if God forbid an individual was killed in an earthquake or in a terrible circumstance, a natural disaster, something like that, we would say they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. In other words, it's not that a miracle didn't happen for them, because if you're standing right next to a wall that's going to fall, the wall's going to fall anyway. The Gemara itself understands that these concepts of sealed and writing are true, but they're also not true. Or they're also considerably more complicated in a way that we can't quite resolve. So turn over to page 8, and let me just point out really two takeaways. One is, and I'll just say this, we didn't see the particular line in the Rambam, Maimonides, but when the Rambam formulates the idea of the Bein Oni, hands up if you think you're likely to be a Beinoni this time next week. I'm not going to. Okay. The person who is in the middle, half and half. So let's say that I am not in the. I'm a Beinoni. I haven't done enough mitzvahs. So the Rambam talks about the fact that everybody in the world has got mitzvahs and averus, good points and bad points. If you are 51% in the good, you're in the book of life. If you are 51% in the bad, you're in the book of death, lo aleinu. If you're 50-50, so then you're suspended between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So what do I have to do to get into the book of life before Yom Kippur? I have to do a mitzvah. Right, I have to do a mitzvah. So the Rambam, right, I have to do more mitzvahs than a bear. I have to be exceedingly careful. Limit your averas to no more than three a day. I have to be extremely careful. So the Rambam does say, by the way, which is the saving grace, and I didn't want to in anyway make the Rambam sound like naive. The Rambam points out, of course, that this shikul, that this accounting, this judging is only according to God's evaluation. Nobody can possibly understand, as we saw before, the blind. Nobody can possibly understand why God will choose to judge an individual, what he takes into account, what not. Rav Moshe Feinstein indicates that some generations are going to be punished for us to be, let's say the generation that came to America that struggled to, if you didn't come into work on a Saturday, they were fired. That generation was clearly going to be judged by God with more compassion regarding Chilul Shabbat than a generation that was all wealthy and self-sufficient, etc. So nobody can possibly know how God judges and how he counts. Nobody. And that's really the Rambam's kind of saving grace, because all the questions you can ask, he'll say, well, how do you know? How do you know who God decided to be righteous and wicked? Nonetheless, going back to Rav Hutner, the Pachid, Rav Isaac Hutner from New York, the Torah Das Yeshiva, or Chaim Berlin Yeshiva, he says as follows. The Rambam says that a person who wants to get into the Book of Life in Yom Kippur, it's not a question of him doing another mitzvah or extra mitzvot. The Rambam says he has to do tshuva. From here comes the insight that what we're talking about ultimately is an attitude to life. That beinoni is, because how could it possibly be, given how many billions of deeds and thoughts you have every day, how could it possibly be that a person would ever be exactly 50-50? It's just not, it's impossible. So rather the Rambam says a tzaddik is an individual who identifies with the good side. It might not be perfect, but my heart is with the good. And a wicked is a person whose heart is really given over to the bad. And what's the Beinoni? Beinoni is a person who can't quite make up their mind. You know, they like the goods, and they also like the bad. They know what's right and wrong, but they enjoy doing wrong as much as they enjoy doing right. They feel, not just they feel themselves torn, they have on some level an ambivalence. They know what they should be doing, but quite frankly, often they just really can't be bothered to do it. So that's a midah benefesh, as Rav Hutner. It's an attitude rather than a number. And for a Beinoni may have done way more mitzvahs than averas. But if you're ambivalent, you don't particularly identify with one more than the other, then you're a Beinoni, and in order to get into the Book of Life, you have to do tshuva. It's a classic and a beautiful insight. But we'll finish with Rabbi Sacks. And Rabbi Sacks, the bottom here of page 8, the last source. Because Rabbi Sacks, in talking about, and this is from his commentary in the Machzor, he talks about in the Tani Tokef. There is, and even though it's sort of implied in the Gemara of Kruspadai that tshuva tzedakah tefillah, the way in Natan Tokef is this masterful prayer that arches from the imagery of the dust in the winds and God's heavenly throne and everything in between, and the shepherd and the human heart and the heartbreak and the suffering, me and Noah, just this sweep of this prayer. And what is it? Is it about God's arbitrary judgment or God's inscrutable judgment? So Rabbi Sacks has the following insight that is so meaningful and so insightful. Western civilization, I love Rabbi Sacks, Western civilization is a product of two cultures, ancient Greece and ancient Israel. The Greeks believed in fate. The future is determined by the past. Jews believed in freedom. There is no evil decree that cannot be averted. That is the chiddush of Unatan Tokef. Mavirin et ro hagezera. No matter what you have done, you can always change. ubiyom ad yom moto techak elo. And God is waiting for you to the very last breath. The Greeks gave the world the concept of tragedy. Jews gave it the idea of hope. The whole of Judaism, though it would take a book to show it, is a set of laws and narratives designed to create in people, families, communities, and a nation habits that defeat despair. Judaism is the voice of hope in the conversation of mankind. This is ultimately not about the fact that we're doomed and that we're sealed. It is ultimately about the fact that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, God gives us another chance. We've already written ourselves in the book. The question is, are we going to take the chance he gives us to try again and to try harder? And that's a question, the real question, which we're judged on Rosh Hashanah. I really wish you all Shana Tova, Ketiva, V'chatima Tova. Next Wednesday is Tzom Gedalia. We'll be out Tzom Gedalia. So next Wednesday's class will be on Thursday. So the Yom Kippur class of the series will be next Thursday evening. Thank you so much for listening, and I really wish everybody a Shana Tova.